Okay, the next speaker is Ole Olmundsen. He works with the Shakopee Mittawakaton Sioux community, and he's a water resource scientist there and has been since 2006. And title of his presentation is Aquifer Recharge Through Injection at the Shakopee Mittawakaton Sioux Community. Ole Olmundsen.
All right, well, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to this group today. Like Eric said, my name is Ole Olmundsen. I work for the Shakopee Mittawakaton Sioux Community. And it takes about three times to get that pronunciation right, so you got there. A lot of what we've been talking about today is recharge in more of a passive capacity. The last talk we had increased that a little bit and added some pressure to the equation. And this talk goes a little bit further into actually talking about injection specifically for the purposes of recharge. I want to talk to you a little bit about the community in general, the Shakopee Mittawakaton, who we are and kind of what makes us different and our relationship in the region with the state and the country. Go over the geologic setting a little bit and then talk about our water system as a whole. And then get into sort of the results of what we've been studying for our specific injection project, looking first at the modeling, some of the treatment tests, and some of the column studies that were done, and kind of finish up with what the system would look like at completion. There we go. So the Shakopee Mittawakaton Sioux community, usually we just say SMSC, and we're a federally recognized Indian tribe. And as such, we're not subject to Minnesota authority from a regulatory perspective, and therefore most of our oversight comes from the federal government, in this case mostly the EPA. And so therefore the rules and regulations that apply to a lot of you folks here are not necessarily quite the same as us, although in all cases we try to work very closely with the state to make sure we're coming close or meeting the standards that would be applied to the rest of our neighbors. We have about 3,900 acres right now. And as land acquisitions happen, that grows a little bit from year to year. But one of the reasons we were looking at injection as a necessity for us or a possibility is that we're fairly geographically constrained, as you'll see in the next slide. We have a fairly small footprint and not a whole lot of room to grow with our neighbors developing toward us and us developing toward our neighbors. And that limits our ability to have access to the water resources that are currently available. In all matters, the tribe is striving for self-sufficiency, both through economic means of some of our enterprises, the casinos, hotel, golf course, banks, convenience stores and such, and also socially through their own local tribal governments. And because of that, you'll see our population there is listed at 325 people. So you might think, well, why do 325 people need to think about injecting water back into their system? But on a daily basis with the employees and the guests that come and go throughout the various enterprises, we're actually considered to have a population equivalent of about 15,000 people. So our infrastructure needs to support that type of system. This slide was from a different talk. I assume you all know where Minnesota is. Kind of right in here. It's Minnesota. We're located just southwest of the metro area. You can see the 494 loop right here. We're down here. Shakopee and Prior Lake are good neighbors. You can see the yellow line is sort of the border between the Shakopee and Prior Lake areas, and we straddle that line right here in red. That's the Shakopee Mittawakaton Sioux community lands. And so from a water supply perspective, we have two fairly distinct regions. We have a north side here and a south side, and almost a much larger portion of our water is used in that southern region down here, and there's actually two water systems that operate somewhat independently. And so we're going to focus on the southern area today, and down there we have three production wells, two of them in the Jordan, one a little bit deeper in the Fig, which doesn't really come into play in the realm of this project. Pumping about 190 million gallons a year. Pretty standard treatment for iron and manganese. That's what a lot of our neighbors do. But we take it a step further. This is on the drinking water side. We have a fairly substantial reverse osmosis system in place, and that's because we've noticed surface water chloride levels increasing throughout the years, and a lot of that is can be contributed to road salts. But because of the large hotel operation, casino, and other operations we have that are using water softeners, we felt this was a better way to reduce the mineral content of the water and not have the residual chlorides that can be associated with water softening. So by adding that reverse osmosis system, we've been able to cut those systems out almost completely in most cases. And so therefore, on the front end, we're running that reverse osmosis, which makes the water a little bit more expensive. So any chance we have to sort of reduce pumping and reduce this type of treatment, we look for ways to do that. About 10 years ago, a little bit less, we constructed a very modern wastewater treatment facility that currently processes about 150 million gallons a year. And right now that's all discharged to the surface and flows through a series of ponds and streams and wetlands. And we'll look at the path in a minute, but that the plant was overbuilt to be able to treat almost 900 million gallons a year, so that in the event that we increase our needs, the infrastructure already exists. So to talk a little bit about the geologic features then of the region, pretty standard Minnesota glacial till, about 50, 75 feet, and then a lot of the boring logs show a really clean sand and gravel layer before we get down to the Prairie du Chien, which overlays the Jordan Sandstone, which is the primary aquifer for most of our neighbors, a good producer and not too deep. And then below that is the St. Lawrence, which confines the lower units, which don't really come into play here. I think this map that illustrates our geology pretty well. You can see most of the region is this light blue, sort of a purple Prairie du Chien formation, but we have a very distinct buried bedrock valley that runs kind of right through the center of this map here, and it really lets you see the layers kind of as they go down, and that bedrock valley cuts all the way down to the Ironton-Galesville in spots, but on the surface there's very little expression of this. It's completely filled in with glacial sediments, so it's kind of difficult to know exactly where it is. This is a pretty good idea, but on the edges there's a lot of unknowns because we're just going off of the boring logs that we have. It's important to note these blue arrows here indicate predominant groundwater flow direction for the Jordan Sandstone, and you can see it flows from the southeast to the northwest in our region. And that factor was taken into consideration when planning this project. So why inject? Well, for us, we have a growing population, both locally as our residents continue to increase and our visitors and guests increase as our enterprises grow in size. And that will lead to increased pumping. We've seen it almost every year, an increase in pumping, and so the need for more water exists. We know that from modeling done by the Met Council in looking out to 2030, we see some drawdown here. This is a predicted Prairie du Chien drawdown. We see some really high areas here in the eastern portion of the seven county metro, but down where we are, it's kind of easy to pick out because of that buried bedrock valley. Right here, we expect, based on this modeling, to see about 5 to, you know, as high as maybe 20 feet of drawdown from our principal aquifer. And so, looking forward, we know that we need to take that into account and change our practices accordingly. Additionally, where we're located is a little bit higher in elevation than our surrounding areas. We have the Minnesota River runs right to the north up here, and we're located in this area. Our water treatment facility is here, and this path here with the blue and the yellow arrows to the black is our current path of wastewater effluent. So we discharge to the surface. It kind of runs through the property, but doesn't necessarily infiltrate too much until we get out here, and this is sort of the edge of the valley, goes down the hill, and runs back across the highway. And in this spot here, that those black arrows, we have a stream that completely disappears. So all of our effluent is actually infiltrating. So one might say, well, that's successful. We're getting it back into the aquifer. But unfortunately, if you remember correctly, our groundwater flow direction is in the southeast to northwest direction, and that takes it out of our local loop. So it's getting down by the river, maybe getting into the aquifers down there, but it's no longer in our area of influence where our drinking water wells draw from. And so the whole point is to capture this effluent instead of losing it off the hill, to put it back in somewhere where we can reutilize it through our drinking water system and kind of close the loop. So back in 2005, and a little bit earlier, we started talking about the possibility of taking our treated effluent from the wastewater and re-injecting it somewhere near our drinking water system to do exactly that and close the loop. So the first thing that was done was a series of boreholes were drilled and the cores were examined. And we'll look at a cross-section that was generated here from F to F prime. You can note that the blue circle here, this is where our water treatment facility is, and the injection site is very near that, just to the west. And what was found and was this layer of glacial till, sandy clay, some till. There's a good mix in there. But below it, a very clean sand and gravel layer, and it seemed very extensive and quite even. And our injection site is right around in here, so that's about 100 feet of not only clean sand and gravel, but you can see the water level there in blue is below that, the local water table. And so there seems to be a very large void space that would be a good candidate for receiving this injected water. And also, injecting above the aquifer means we're not directly introducing it back into the drinking water system. We're kind of putting it right up above and then letting it work its way down and through. So, like I hinted to, the plan would be to screen a well or a series of wells just in that sand and gravel layer, right below the till, just to the top of the Prairie du Chien, and then only inject seasonally. So the last talk was talking about other reuse opportunities like golf courses, and you know, irrigation is a popular reuse activity, but you know, it's frozen down here where we are too, and so it's not really viable for the whole year. So we would plan on injecting during sort of that off season, the fall, winter, spring months, and when we were injecting, we would put 100% of that treated stream down into the well. Currently, we have about 300 gallons a minute or 400,000 gallons a day available for injection, but the system was modeled to go as high as 1,300 GPM because we expect expansion into the future, and so building it to handle flows much higher was probably a good idea. So after we had the boreholes and the stratigraphy looked good, it was on to some modeling and a few different scenarios. So the injection rates here for scenarios 1 through 4 increased from 450 up to 1330. And these hydraulic conductivities were taken from the actual cores. And you can see the last two have the same pumping rates of 1332. But the main difference there is simulation number 4 takes into drastically reduces the hydraulic conductivity to sort of get at a worst-case scenario. If we were totally off on that conductivity, how would the system still operate? And so the second table there, 1 through 4, shows the results of that. Mostly what I'd like to highlight is this change in head. So at the lowest level, we bring that water table up about 51 feet. And in sort of worst-case scenario, we bring it up about 170 feet. And leaving 150 feet ahead in the low pumping scenario and about 25 feet of headspace remaining in the higher pumping scenario. This illustrates that maximum pumping rate with the worst possible hydraulic conductivity estimates. And you can see the radius here is about 300-400 feet, that groundwater mound, and it comes up, like we said, about 170 feet. And there's really not much around here in the way of neighbors. I believe there's a few wells in the area, but most of this is served by the public water supply operated by the Midwakaton Sioux. So we're not getting too close to anybody's personal property. What we are getting close to is our own 10-year time of travel. That long elongated oval there is our own Jordan Aquifer 10-year time of travel modeling results from the pumping rates that we were modeling at that time. And you can see the sort of the spider-looking thing right down below it is that groundwater mound from the proposed injection. The flow paths that are coming off of it are 5-month flow paths, so you can see the sort of the area that we would expect that water to flow out during our 5-month injection period, and you can see they just intersect a little bit. So, you know, sort of ballpark figure would be 8 to 10 years from injection to sort of getting all the way back to our drinking water supply. So once the model seemed to give us some reasonable answers and results, and so it was time to move on to an actual pilot project to see in real life how this might work. So in our current wastewater treatment facility, we had constructed sort of a mini version of what would be in place if we were to go through with this, and that included reverse osmosis and ultraviolet light and ozone for a advanced oxidation process. And between the three of those, we put together this system, and the reverse osmosis is here, and then UV here, and ozone here, and it comes out the other side, and that would be the water that would be ready for injection. And so it's important to pay attention here to site one, which is this is coming out of our current wastewater treatment plant, and then the advanced treatment here, and then seven would be the final product there. And we're going to look at a series of test results that compare the two, the before and after, for various constituents of contaminants that we're looking for. So our water quality goals, as was talked about in the last talk, meeting drinking water standards isn't quite good enough. And so we went to 5 different sources to try to find the components that we were interested in making sure were taken care of with this type of treatment. First on the list was the primary drinking water standards, but also secondary standards from the EPA and the contaminant candidate list. And then more locally, looking at the Minnesota Department of Health, the health-based water guidance table. And then I think going out to look at the California drinking water notification levels, they're the ones that are doing this on a large scale. They've been doing it for a while. And so they're looking at their list was pretty important to us. And so we kind of took all those together and made our own list of what we'd be looking for in our particular project, and came up with 52 contaminants that we thought represented a good cross-section of various classes, like pharmaceutical, personal care, industrial chemicals, and also among those then had diverse properties, things that responded to treatment differently, so we could really get a broad range of chemicals that reacted to this treatment. We were also looking for things with common and affordable measurement techniques. If it's sort of cutting edge and you're not sure about the methods being used at the lab, is probably not a good thing to test for, at least to be confident in your results. And other things we were looking for were components that maybe were of more of a local concern that maybe California didn't have interest in because it didn't exist out there or other reasons. And of course, most of them, we were concerned about them because they had some sort of health or environmental risk. So kind of pulled all those lists together, made our own list, and from that went ahead with these tests. So these are the most common that we found coming through the system. And we've got DEET-2 quite a bit. But the good news is DEET is completely removed by this process, so you don't have to worry about it too much. Other components of note are hard to pronounce, but they're here. And some down at the end here, you can see it's important to point out that site one, so the pre-treatment is in blue, and the after-treatment is in yellow, so there's no yellow there, which means it was completely removed. And other ones were removed down to certain percentages. Down here at the end, you'll see the naphthalenes and methanols and sort of that group showed up in very low concentrations and didn't really respond to the treatment too well. So that's important to point out. Sort of as a summary then for that removal process, about 61% of all the mass was taken out, and many of the constituents removed below detectable limits. And any of the remaining contaminants that were found were well below health-based risk levels. So we feel like the treatment levels that were being carried out here were adequate for having confidence in introducing this water back into the aquifer. So we must be ready to inject. Well, not quite, because there's a possibility that the water we're creating is actually too clean. We want to make sure that we're introducing it back to the system in a state that's similar to to the water that's coming out. And so other things that need to be considered would include the pH of the water, the hardness of the water that we're, both the water that we're putting back in and the water that's already down there. And especially concerned with the mineral types of the receiving body that's already there. What types of constituents might be in there that could be mobilized because of the activities that we're doing if the water doesn't play well with that. So we need to do a few more tests. And so we kind of did it in two phases, batch testing and column testing. And the batch testing we broke down into two parts. So we'll talk about those first. We want to know what happens when treated water interacts with these geologic units. We could have massive iron oxidation and plug up the screens, and suddenly we're not injecting anything because that we've lost all porosity right around the well. We could dissolve the Prairie du Chien if our pH isn't right. Or, like I said, we could mobilize things like arsenic, lead, or mercury. And these are things that have been problems elsewhere, so it's kind of a good idea to take that into account before you drill that first well. So test A was pretty simple. Line up a bunch of jars, mix a lot of the cuttings that we took from the cores, add the water to it and let it sit for a while, and then sample that. And various mixtures of water were used, both the completely treated water from the end of the process, and then it was also adjusted with lime and pH to change the properties a little bit. And based on that testing, we really saw no mobilized constituents. There was slight differences, but nothing out of the ordinary that would send up alarms. What we did find was that 55 milligrams per liter of lime, and then using CO2 to adjust the pH back to 7.5 was sort of the optimum, what seemed to be the optimum level of treatment for that first test. And so that scenario then was carried forward into all the rest of the tests. We would either use unstabilized water, so water right out of the treatment process, or water stabilized in condition to these levels. So test B wanted to address the fact that not all of the geologic units are going to be encountered at the same time by this water. It's going to move through the system. It's going to be in contact with the glacial till, and then later the sand and gravel, and then finally the Prairie du Chien. And so a new test was set up that represented various vertical segments of that column, and the water was introduced either in the unconditioned state or treated to these levels, left to sit again for a number of weeks, and then sampled and analyzed. And what we found there was that we did see some arsenic in about 25% of those samples. It was in fairly low concentrations, but it was there, and it was something we needed to take note of. So then on to the column tests. The final test was then to move the water physically through the columns. Instead of just sitting on a shelf in a jar, we know that it's a dynamic environment once you start injecting. And so a test was made up to reflect that environment. And that included taking cores that were saved from the original drilling and put into these PVC sleeves here, a couple tall ones and a couple short ones, and then the water was moved through that, all of them representing various phases of the column that would move through in actuality. And you can see that was they were done in parallel, so there's one row on this side and one row on the back side. And those were, again, treated with the unstabilized water or with the water stabilized with lime and CO2 to the levels we talked about earlier. And the results, so this is a flow chart again just to show you. So here's the treatment up here, and then this was the column test down here going forward. So the sample site now is at the end of these columns here and here, and then those two were compared. So here and there. The most important one to look at, I think, is arsenic, because that, you know, people hear that word and they get a little bit excited. So we want to illustrate our findings for arsenic in our area. There's kind of a lot of colors here. I'll walk you through them. Red, the red trace that kind of goes all over the place, that's the unstabilized water. So right out of the treatment process and run through the columns, and there's our results. The blue one, that's quite a bit lower and less variable, that is the stabilized water. And we're comparing those to known levels. So 10 micrograms per liter is the maximum contaminant level for arsenic in drinking water. And then purple and green, those straight lines in purple and green, those are the background levels. So we found two Jordan wells, sampled the water out of them, and measured the naturally occurring arsenic in there. And you can see the conditioned water that was run through the columns initially started right about the same as one of our Jordan wells, and then decreased in concentration as time went on, and kind of started hovering around that lower concentration and even dipped below for quite some time. And so based on this test, we feel that if we properly condition the water before we inject it, where arsenic isn't a concern as far as mobilizing additional arsenic into the column. Some of the other test results, and this is for the stabilized water. Calcium was similar in and out, so that was kind of the point of stabilizing it with lime, is that we kind of balance out that calcium, so we're not depositing any, we're not picking any up, and the tests show that 55 milligrams per liter for us was probably a pretty good level. Total dissolved solids, a little bit of an increase in those. Magnesium, silicon, strontium. We saw an increase in the stabilized water, but it was less than the unstabilized water and not a really a big problem. And then sodium, potassium, aluminum, and barium didn't seem to care whether the water was stabilized or not. They were similar in both the unstabilized and the stabilized. So now going forward with this knowledge, we know that everything seems to be in line for a successful injection project. The plan would be to drill three wells, keep two of them in service at any one time, and doing any maintenance we might need, or letting a third one rest and sort of rotating those through. Inject about 350,000 gallons per day, which, if you remember from the modeling scenarios, is a little bit lower than our lowest modeled scenario. So as far as a physical impact just to the groundwater table, initially it would be fairly small. And the current status, though, the whole project is on hold right now as we're looking at other avenues of reusing that water. So our golf course is using water for irrigation in the summertime, and a year and a half ago or so, we put in a reuse system for a lot of the other areas around our enterprises for irrigation purposes. So we're drawing water out of a pond that receives the surface effluent right now, and so we're pursuing that avenue, and we've done this work, and we're glad we did. And if we need this type of system in the future, we kind of are ready to go. But right now, we're just kind of waiting to see if we need it and what kind of urgency we have in that regard. Another reason why we're not ready to barrel forward either is that a lot of the bore holes did indicate a small layer of clay right between the sand and gravel layer and the top of the Prairie du Chien. And there's enough of a question as to how much that would impede infiltration between that sand and gravel receiving unit and the aquifer below, because we might end up in a situation where the preferential flow is actually due to the topography of the bedrock instead of the predominant groundwater flow, in which case we may not be closing that loop as much as we think. But we don't. There's not a good, really good way to know how extensive that clay layer is. So because of those factors, we're, like I said, on hold right now. But we're happy to discuss the project with anyone and share our test results. And that's kind of why I'm here today, is because we think it's a viable technology, and one that moving forward, even water abundant places like Minnesota, may be able to utilize. And so we hope this work sort of helps anyone who's interested sort of make that decision if they feel it's right for them. So we do feel right now we have, the area has adequate water. We know there's a predicted drawdown, and we feel our geologic advantage is there for having such a system, and our facilities are in good shape to move into something like that. And the testing shows that the water quality conditions can be met. And so if we choose to move in that direction, we'll do so with confidence. Thanks for your attention, and if you have any questions, I'd love to answer them. RO reject goes to the wastewater treatment facility. We have data on the chloride reduction. It's data I'm not really familiar with, but I would happily give you my card and can get you that data. So that's what I showed early on. It flows through a system of streams off the hill and down into the sort of the sand plain down there and disappears to the north.
I think I can yell enough to. Are you to the point here in terms of the development of this particular project where you're thinking about implementation? And if so, what are you thinking about actual monitoring of this system when it hits the natural system?
Right. So the question was, in case you didn't hear it, if we implement or when we implement, what would our monitoring strategy be? And I didn't really cover it in here, but a series of monitoring wells would be drilled at various distances away, mostly in the northwest direction. But since we have that buried bedrock valley and the clay layer we're not so sure about, we would put some to the south in the perimeter as well to monitor that, both for level and for quality. Have we talked to the Minnesota Department of Health? Yes. And? Well, it's an interesting relationship because they can have an opinion, but we don't have to necessarily abide by it, although we definitely value their opinion highly. And it hasn't gotten to the point where we're definitely going to do it, so we definitely need to get everything lined up. But before we did it, we would certainly, and we have had a number of public meetings with neighbors and the state in various counties, and should it move further anymore, we would definitely make sure everyone was on the same page.
Nobody wants the mic. Make him use it. All right.
Is it necessary that the injected water go into back into your supply well, or would it be sufficient that the injected water raised the heads nearby so you could potentially inject downgradient from your well and still maintain heads in the well?
Well, I think that's a reasonable question, and I think you would achieve the same goal. For us, I think it's convenient that our wastewater treatment facility is upgradient of our current well, and therefore that's kind of where we're putting it anyway. But yeah, I think it's a good point.
On the way back, I'll ask a question. Do I understand correctly there are two reverse osmosis systems, one coming in and one going out? And in which case is that duplication good, necessary?
So there would be two reverse osmosis systems. And I think it would be necessary because we're doing it for two completely different reasons. The first is to control the hardness and reduce chlorides in the surface water. And the second would be to remove a lot of the contaminants that are large enough to be caught on those membranes. I guess maybe you could make the argument if we went ahead with it, stop reverse osmosising the drinking water and then soften again and then just treat for chlorides at the end with that reverse osmosis system. I don't think I have a good answer, but it's a good point.
I'm curious to know what the cost per gallon is for conventional wastewater treatment versus your treatment train.
So am I. I don't know what the cost per gallon would be for that final one. I know that the price tag, the sort of the ballpark price tag on this system that I just described is a little bit over $5 million, and how we didn't generate an operational cost, though. That was merely construction. So that's what I can give you. All over the place.
Who's first?
Okay. We got time for a couple more. I want to shorten our break.
So with all the treatment you're doing, why not just drink the water?
That's a great question. And in a different version of this talk, I actually show a couple slides from California of me drinking that kind of water. You can take the tour out in Orange County, and you can drink the treated wastewater at the end. And walk away, okay. But the biggest reason we don't is because of public perception. I was in Tucson looking at a similar system, and they called it a public perception buffer. If you take that water and you put it underground for any period of time, and then bring it up again, then the public's okay with it. But if you connect those pipes, then they have a problem. So. You could just put a pipe underground, that's right.
If I understood you right, you got said it in answer to a question in the back that your reverse osmosis reject water goes into your sewage treatment plant.
Yes.
And if you're stripping chloride on both ends, you're just going to build up the chlorides in your plant, I think.
Well, that's a good point, but we're not stripping chlorides on the front. We're stripping hardness like calcium and other minerals. So we're taking chloride out of the system by not using water softeners in the middle. So our drinking water supply isn't high in chlorides to begin with. We're doing reverse osmosis for other minerals. But, yeah, a good question.
Okay, over here and then.
I have a two-part question.
Oh, okay.
The second part, actually, you mentioned it. Have you evaluated what is the buffer time period of storage before you pump it up?
Well, we sort of just kind of ballparked it with the slide I showed with our injection, our five-month time of travel, and how that just intersected with the edge of our 10-year time of travel from our well. So I would guess 8 to 10 years would sort of close that loop. And for reference, in Orange County, their loop is about 6 months.
So
similar treatment, similar results. Our gap is a lot bigger.
And the first part of the question is, it seems like it has been a long process. Are you doing this one on your own, or actually US EPA Region 5 is involved, or how you come up with the roadblocks and then navigate to the next step?
We've been working with the EPA. They've been interested in what we're doing and fairly supportive of it. I don't have a lot of specifics on that, but we've certainly had them in the loop, so I don't think we'd have any big surprises from them if we decided to go forward.
Over here.
Considering your area is kind of small for, I mean, for the geographic distribution of the aquifers, I wonder what kind of hydrogeological boundaries do you use for your computer model?
I wasn't really involved with the computer modeling, but I know to the north we have the Minnesota River, so that was our hydrogeologic boundary to the north. And I can't really tell you exactly the boundaries that were chosen for the other areas. Sorry. Lan, you might know.
I'm trying to remember. I used to work for the Minnewaukan Sioux community.
I have to admit that I was part of the, helped with some of the modeling, and there are others in the room too, so I was muttering to myself about, there's another buried bedrock valley further to the east, and then you also do have some of the aquifer doesn't extend to the west, and so those kind of help shape some of those hydrologic boundaries, but that was a while ago. I'm still racking my brains.
Let's cut it off here. A big hand for Oli.